Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And you're welcome to give us a call in here if Saturday, June 20th is the date where you are, at 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400. Another exciting hour of economics jargon.
Yes. There's a couple of things going on out there that I think are significant, one of which you can have an effect on, perhaps. Your representative, in case you didn't know it, is Judge John Carter. He's called Judge because he used to be a district judge down in Williamson County. And the House, he's on the appropriation. He's on the budget committee, I think. But anyway, the House Appropriations Committee. Well, I don't remember the Appropriations Committee. I think it was that voted down on a party line vote. They voted a bill through, hasn't hit the floor of the House yet. That would forbid the Department of Labor to spend any money to enforce one of its rules. And the rule is a result of a bill passed by the Republican Congress in 2006. And it says that a person who gives advice on a retirement account, because about a third of that retirement account is actually the property of the federal government, it's taxes that haven't been paid yet, must act as a fiduciary. It's taken him from 2006 to 2015 to come up with a rule because there's been a lot of people fighting it.
Let me hit that real quick, because we use the word fiduciary, and I'm going to define it in a way that is legally accurate without the huge definition. And that is, a fiduciary must act in the best interest of their client. So this is what the argument is about. And there's a suitability standard, which means that somebody acts in pretty okay interest of their client, but doesn't have to put their client first. And then there's the fiduciary standard, where someone gives advice and must put the interests of their client above their own. That's pretty clear to me. Like, sounds like a better deal. You don't want a doctor giving you advice when their interests supersede yours. You might get prosthetic arms.
Well, the point is that, as Jake said, the bill is very simple. It says if somebody's going to give you advice on an IRA, they have to disclose their fees, any under-the-table kickbacks they're getting, and they have to be acting in your best interest, not in their best interest. And the insurance lobby, the brokerage lobby has slammed this thing as hard as they could, and they are putting literally hundreds of millions of dollars into lobbying to keep this from being passed because they said it would prevent people from serving you. In essence, what it would do is it would keep high commission, hidden fee deals from being used in IRAs and retirement plans. And I can tell you from 33 years of experience in the business of investing and selling investments for 25 years, it is absolutely a common affair for people to sell you something to put in your IRA or your 403B that if you had any idea how much money they were going to make on that, how much money of your money was going to wind up in their pockets, you would bolt and run out of the office. And the end result is your ability to actually make money on your investments is extremely minimal because it's dependent upon huge rates of return in the future that may or may not be there. And on the other hand, if a person is a fiduciary, that's not that they can't charge you huge amounts of money under the DOL's proposed rule. It's that they have to tell you how much they're charging you. How much it's going to cost you to get into this particular investment. And they have to make that very clear. And this is the other side of it. They have to sign off, and this is really making them angry.
This is the big one right here.
They have to sign off on a contract that says if you have broken the rule and lied to them, you can sue them. Right now, you can't.
There's one other piece here. There's a disclosure piece of paper that needs to be signed. This is part of the new rule. And that piece of paper says that you as the client recognize that the person on the other end of the table from you right now is not working in your best interest.
That's right.
And they don't like that. For some reason, they don't like you knowing that they're not working in your best interest.
You know, they're getting paid by somebody else, and it's natural economic behavior by somebody. If I can make, if you bring in your IRA and you've got thousands of dollars in there, and I'm a broker, and if I can get, if I have the choice of getting, let's say you've got $100,000, and I have a choice of making over the next year $1,000, or I can make $10,000 off of your IRA, I have a funny feeling that the person, the offer that the broker can get a $10,000 payment for your $100,000 IRA is far more attractive. And I have seen it as high as $14,000 offered to the broker.
And when they look at it, they say, well, this isn't necessarily bad for the client. It's a good thing that they're getting into. They just have to stay in it a long time to see if they can ever get anything back out of it.
And on insurance products, by the way, life insurance in particular, and you're going to think this is amazing, the commission in the first year can exceed the amount of money you put in the first year.
Yeah.
And that's why the huge surrender charges as years go by. So it doesn't happen with every life insurance product, but this is the deal where we will guarantee you some return into the far distant future. However, if you try to take the money out, it won't be there because we paid it to the salesman.
I'm going to give you a comparison to something else that's happening in the news, and it's going to sound for a moment that I'm changing the subject completely. I'm not. I'm going to tie them together. Last week and the week before, we talked about the Office of Personnel Management and the hacking that was done, and the Chinese have access to all of this. Well, it's coming out in the congressional hearings on it now that a portion of the IT department for this group was contracted out to Argentina, and about half of the Argentinian employees were actually Chinese employees in China. So the congressional hearings are now looking at this and saying, why was this allowed? How is this possible? This seems like it's a surface level thing. You should be able to look at this and say it's wrong. When we're talking about fiduciary suitability, we're talking about exactly the same thing. We're talking about the only reason why this is an issue is because people don't know about it. If people know about this, then it's not an issue. If you know going into a meeting with a stockbroker that this is a salesperson, then you're a lot better off than if you go in not knowing that. If you go into a meeting with somebody who's supposed to be working in your best interest and they're not, then there should be penalties for that person. Those penalties don't exist on the stockbroker side in the same way, in the sales side in the same way, because they're not required by law to work in the client's best interest.
So you can affect this. You can go to John Carter's website and send him an email and simply say, I am for the fiduciary rule. Just that simple. I support the fiduciary rule. You may have to, I had to look up fiduciary the first time I dealt with it and figure out how to spell it. But still, don't send them a chain letter or anything like that. But I'm just simply saying, this is a good thing with large insurance companies and brokerage companies and their lobbying organizations spending hundreds of millions of dollars to prevent it from happening. They can't stop it because they don't have the votes to overturn a law they passed in 2006, but they can prohibit the Department of Labor from spending any money on the rule. And that is absurd that they're doing it, and it frankly offends me, but that's okay. That's the nature of politics and big money.
One of the interesting factors here is the state of Texas has a law on the books. It's a good law that says that doctors that are treating you are not allowed to own the pharmacy that gives you the medication that they prescribed. And the reason is because for a long time, doctors made a lot more money prescribing the drug than in treating the person. So they separated the two and they said only prescribe drugs when they're needed, which most people think that's a pretty good idea. That's a fiduciary standard. When you know how someone's being paid and they're working directly for you, then a lot of the conflicts that arise in these situations disappear because you know they're working directly for you. In many cases, a stockbroker will say, or a life insurance agent, I've heard this many times. You don't pay me, the company does. How do you think the company got paid? So that convoluted thinking is, if we're talking about a security organization, the Office of Personnel Management, I brought that up a second ago, a security organization, they're the people that review security clearances for government employees. They go through a lot of information to figure out if someone is capable of keeping secrets. And they had a large percentage of their IT department working in Russia. Another large percentage working in China. They had people working in Argentina. This doesn't pass the smell test, but you have to lift the shroud a little bit and look underneath what's going on down there. When it comes to your financial future, what's going on in the United States right now? And this is something that if you're listening to this program, you're already aware of it, but I'm going to be redundant and tell you again anyway. Your financial future rests in your own hands. And the younger you are, the more true that is, because at some point, the obligations of the government to pay you in retirement are not going to be able to be honored. They're going to be changed in some way. It's going to happen. This isn't a question of maybe it will happen. You can just run the numbers. They don't lie. Unless we have some crazy astronomical fantasy land type growth in the economy, we're not going to be able to afford Social Security for the millennial generation. It's just, and most of the Xers. Keeping that in mind, if you don't take responsibility for yourself, you're in trouble. Now, there's two types of people you can go to help get that responsibility firmly on your shoulder. There's one that may not tell you how they're getting paid, that may not tell you if this is the best choice that they think is possible, or they may tell you, but it may not be right, and you're expected to know that they may be fibbing a little bit. And there's another group that you go to that's required to tell you the truth, required to tell you how much and when and why they're getting paid. That seems to me like an obvious situation, the fact that they're calling it the fiduciary role, when most people don't know what fiduciary means. They think it's some kind of a tree that takes extra watering or something. This is the problem. If we don't have an internal education system, the government's not going to do this one for you. You've got to learn on your own who you can trust and who you can't. The government does need to step in and say, let's make it clear in a very easily understood piece of paper that the person you're talking to is either in your best interest or not.
Okay.
That's it. We've kicked that a lot. We're not being very funny today.
No. There's another issue out there. By the way, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone numbers in here are 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
There's another pair of issues out there that were announced this week that I think are significant for anyone who's listening to the show right now. One of them it came out of the Congressional Budget Office.
Assuming someone is listening.
Right.
That's a big assumption.
You're listening and I'm listening. And
I'm not listening.
Okay.
Telling you that.
Congressional Budget Office said that the deficit situation will probably improve in the United States over the next 10 years. And beyond that, it goes bonkers.
That's a technical term.
And by that I mean the deficits will probably explode about 10 years from now. And what's going to cause those deficits? And this is presuming we don't have a war, that the current budget with the military spending being reduced continues. And the issue is it's Social Security and Medicare that are likely to drive us horrifically into debt beyond our abilities to sustain. I mean, literally, they called the term unsustainable debt growth.
Yeah.
Now, what does that mean to you? Very frankly, it means you need to be investing. You need to be investing carefully. And you need to be not chasing trends. Why? Because there's a major trend going on in the United States today, just like the transition from defined benefit pension plans where you retired, they gave you a gold watch and they pay you a certain amount of pension for the rest of your life, which is basically what got Greece and everybody else in trouble and is going to get the United States in trouble. The Social Security system, the military retirement system, and the federal retirement systems are that same kind of deal. And they're going to, we're either going to have massive increase, well, actually what the Congressional Budget Office said, we will need to have very substantial increases in taxes and substantial reductions in benefits at the same time. Now, what can you do about it?
It's the same thing that happened, by the way, at General Motors and Chrysler, is that they were spending a third of the price of the car before the car was made just in paying retirement benefits to people. You can't compete that way. And if the government's job is to protect the citizens and regulate industry, and they're spending all their money, all of their revenue plus some, paying for retirement benefits, then they can't do the rest of their job.
So it's pretty clear to me there's a limit to how much taxes can be raised and still increase revenues, the Laffer curve issue. And so benefits are going to be cut. And if you plan on being around more than 10 years from now, and 10 years is not at all a bad time horizon for investing. You need to be investing. And I don't care if you're retired and you think, okay, I'm retired, I don't need to be investing anymore. You really need to seriously consider that no government paycheck to you is going to be secure more than about 10 years from now. And can you deal with that? Can you do something about that? Sure. Start setting aside money towards that almost certain event that's going to occur down the road. And that brings me over to another subject. Barclays banks announced they were going to end trading, and they've been the market maker, in $700 billion. Now, I want to say that again, $700 billion. That's 7/10 of $1 trillion.
That's the size of TARP.
In mortgage bonds that they issued. Now, they're not the only one. The bank, Royal Bank of Scotland, has made that announcement. Several other banks have begun to make that announcement. What's that got to do with you? There's two very important things I think that I can take away from that. Number one, the liquidity in the bond market is getting shaky.
Shaky liquidity. Is that a mixed metaphor?
Yeah, it's kind of like it's Jell-O.
Jell-O. Okay, yeah. So there's Jell-O going on.
So you don't want to depend on Jell-O to hold things up, okay?
Right.
And the end result is that when we start to get interest rate increases, there's reasonable expectations, and I think they're very reasonable, that there will be a lot of people who bolt for the door when they see the bond values falling.
Yeah.
And there may not be enough buyers because there's no bond market like the New York Stock Exchange. There's a bunch of individual market makers, which brings me to what I really wanted to hit on here. The cost of doing business in bond ETFs is rising to the point where the average bond ETF now is exchange-traded fund, and people have dumped mutual funds and gone to exchange-traded funds because brokers can trade them more often, and it makes it a lot of fun, and they make more money. But what happens is when you go to exchange-traded funds, they're not backed by – there's no huge institution backing them.
Mm-mm.
It's just whatever company. So if Barclays, for example, instead of – stopping market making in $700 billion worth of mortgage bonds, if they had determined that they had a bunch of ETFs that they had been issuing, and whoever the ETF issuers makes the market, and if they stop trading in them, you are going to be very hard-pressed to find anybody who will want to buy them. ETFs, you have to approach with extreme care, because any time that you purchase an ETF in the market, it is only as good as what company originally issued it and their willingness to continue to trade. They have no obligation to continue to trade that ETF or to support it in any way. And if they stop supporting it, it will fall through the floor despite whatever underlying element was originally supposed to represent.
Yeah, you said something there at the beginning. I'm going to come back because this is an area that to a lot of people is extremely complicated. They look at the bond market and they don't really understand what's going on there. Why isn't there a stock exchange for the bond market? And the reason is, if you think about what a stock exchange is, you're talking about buying and selling ownership in companies. So if you're thinking about real estate, for instance, and you want to buy and sell real estate, that's great. it's a lot easier and more straightforward because there's some kind of concrete ownership of a thing at some point. In the bond market, well, I'm going to use General Motors because I brought them up earlier. I'm not recommending them as a stock, but in the stock market, General Motors just has a couple of share classes. It's not really that big a deal. It's got some stocks out there. If you want to buy General Motors, you buy General Motors. They have thousands of different issues of debt, and those debts are bonds. They're different maturity dates, different interest rates, different everything, what the collateral is, all of that is different for each issue. And there's no easy way to make an exchange that will trade even one General Motors bond for another because they're different bonds. They have different maturity dates, they have different collateral, they have different everything. One of the good things about the bond market, though, is that it's a lot more predictable. You can look at the bonds and you can say when interest rates go down, bond prices go up. If you own bonds and the interest rates go down, you make money. And when interest rates go up, if you own bonds, you lose money. It's really predictable there. That's a rule that is hard to beat. If you know that interest rates, when they go up, bond prices go down. Unfortunately, a lot of people are moving into the bond market because they're afraid of risk, and they're buying into the bond market, and they're spending a lot of money, more money than even the face value of the bonds in a lot of cases, right as the interest rates are about to go up. And I know a lot of people have trouble with that. When interest rates go up, why do bond prices go down? If you think about the bonds that you issue bonds. If you have a bank account, you're issuing bonds to a bank. The bank owes you that money. You can show up and take that money anytime you want, theoretically, unless you're in Greece. Then they might stop you. But that's
or Iceland.
Right, or Iceland. So that concept is you have loaned money to the bank. The bank then turns around and loans money out. If your bank is paying 1% and another bank says, we're just as safe and we're going to pay you 2%, we're going to pay you 3%, then if it's not too difficult to change banks, you probably will. You might say, I'm going to do that next, time I get a chance, I'm going to move from one bank to another because the interest rates are better. I know this because when people are dealing with their credit cards and they're switching interest rates, it's very true. If interest rates go up on your credit card, what do you do with it? You transfer it to a lower interest credit card. That causes the bank that had the higher interest rate to lose money. When interest rates go up, the value of the loan goes down because people try to get out of it. They try to refinance. They do whatever they can. And if you're the one loaning money, it's really nice if you can loan money to somebody at 8% if they buy a house from you. But what that really means is that person doesn't have good credit, or they would go and get a mortgage at 4%. So you have the risk for the rest of the length of this loan that they're going to refinance. And when you're talking about the bond market, that's the tip of the iceberg. The fact that it is hard to trade bonds is not something most people realize because they're used to ETFs and they're used to stocks. And that's what old Baldy here was talking about.
And the ETFs are getting harder to trade in bonds right now. The average, and this is interesting, if you think about the fact that the yield on even an ETF is very, very low, and a bond ETF, 1.something% on a secure went up to maybe 2 or 3%, and they are costing about 0.5% per trade in spread that you don't see. That's an invisible cost that's in there. The average is around 0.5% per trade. So if you bought an ETF and you sold one a year later and you got a 1% interest on it, you netted zero. And you won't realize that.
And you sold.
You won't realize that until you sell it. And that is really, that's in addition to any brokerage fee that you charged. So now, moving on. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, by the way. We probably need to do some commercials.
Yes. So we've been so exciting. We're talking about bond arbitrage. We're talking about acronyms for trade partnerships. if we haven't increased, I mean, we've gotten a lot of rain, but we may have a flash flood issue from all the drool from the boredom that we're creating.
All right. Well, we're going to break for commercials. We'll be back. And again, we haven't yet talked about Rand Paul's plan to wreck the world. I mean, to lower taxes. and there's another thing. Barron's did a great study. I happen to agree with it because I've done my own study on it and found the same thing. That will be a little surprising to you about active management in equity funds. So we'll be back after these words from KTEM's sponsors. Missing this. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and Jake McClure. And once again, we need to tell you that commercial that you heard at the end there is, frankly, false. And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Caller? Oh, scared them away.
Scared them completely off.
I would have hung up on us, too.
Told you I was going to talk about a couple of things. One of them is, let's talk about Rand Paul for just a moment and his call for a 14.5% tax rate. One of two things is true for Senator Paul. Either Senator Paul is extremely dense and ignorant, or he is being intentionally misleading. Maybe it's a combination of the two, but somewhere in the spectrum of extremely dense and ignorant, which I kind of question given the fact that he has a doctorate, and extremely misleading.
His father has a doctorate.
Well, he does too, I think, doesn't he? Anyway, whatever. He's a senator. He wants to eliminate the payroll tax and drop the tax rate on everything and everybody, including corporations, to 14.5%.
So before we get into what's wrong with it, let me say something that I think is right, because I know you're about to take it apart. His first line, he said, was basically, my conclusion is the tax code can't be fixed and should be scrapped. We should start over.
Well, we did
I have a strong tendency to believe him on that.
Well, we did that in 1986. We completely scrapped the tax code and started over, and what we have now is probably worse than what we had before.
Correct.
So scrapping
yes.
the tax code and starting over is a really bad idea to begin with.
Well, we have to scrap the tax code and then get rid of Congress. So if we replace it with a new one and then no new laws on it.
I think what you
that's
just
said. Not going to happen.
No. The point is that I just want to say something about his proposal because it's one of those things. It's kind of like the Greeks. You want us to be like Greece? Well, follow Rand Paul, because basically it's a proposal that everybody is initially going to love. Cut your taxes to 14.5%. Most people pay around 30%. By the time they get done paying their payroll taxes and their income taxes, they're paying about 15% in income taxes of their total income, and they're paying about 15%. Of their on their payroll tax. Now, retired people, on the other hand, typically pay around 10 to 12% of their income in taxes. So it would be a tremendous tax increase for retired people, unless you're single and you're making about $120,000 a year, in which case you would actually get a tax cut. But there's the problem with this. You got to dig a little bit deep. He admits that the loss in revenue, the reduction in revenue to the federal government over the next 10 years will be measured in trillions of dollars. Did you get that? Measured in trillions of dollars.
Yeah, not only measured in trillions of dollars,
the loss.
The Tax Foundation said it's going to add $4 trillion to the debt in the first decade.
Now, what he said is that's not a problem. His spokesman, because we're going to do some cuts. Well, he didn't say what the cuts were.
Oh, he did. He did.
Actually, his spokesman did.
Yeah. Departments of Education, Energy, and Housing and Urban Affairs.
He didn't actually say that. His spokesman did. But it said, look at his previous proposals. Basically, you get rid of all the education funding for the states from the federal government. You get rid of you start down this whole list of things and you get rid of them. Which is kind of interesting, except the jobs would just transfer someplace else. He's going to have massive laws passed to do that, which the president can't do. But last but not least, his biggest cut, and this is the only place where he can get the cuts that he really wants that would enable him to balance the budget, which he claimed he could do at the same time, is about an 80% cut in the Department of Defense.
Even though his last proposal was for raising defense spending.
Well, he wants, but it would be a huge cut. Basically, this withdraw from all over the world and turn it all over to the Coast Guard. And I mean, it's Coast Guard and National Guard is all we really need, right?
Right. That's basically what he said.
And he would dramatically cut Medicare and dramatically cut Social Security. So when you hear him calling for a 14.5% flat tax and a balanced budget, all I got to say, as I said, he is either profoundly ignorant. First off, the president can't do that.
Yeah, that takes Congress.
And secondly, I must admit this, as I said to Lynn Willey when I wrote him about it, this is truly a balanced and bipartisan plan in that it is, if you read the details in it, it's going to tick everybody off.
Yeah.
I mean, the Democrats are going to absolutely go nuts in anger over cutting Social Security, and once the Republicans realize it means eliminating most of the Department of Defense and basically withdrawing from the rest of the world and letting Russia and China go wherever they want to go. By the way, we did this exact type of thing as we coasted into the Great Depression. Congress cut everything. They cut like mad.
They're not the only ones. If you look at what Europe is doing with Greece.
Right.
Call it austerity there. We're just not going to spend anything. Well, the government is about a quarter of the ongoing GDP. When people have worked for the military and they have retirement, or whether they get Social Security or Medicare, the government is a big chunk of that. And this is the problem, one of the problems. There's a lot of problems with Rand Paul's thing. Just because you get rid of the Department of Education doesn't mean that people stop being educated.
Well, what he would do is he stop making student loans, stop any education. By the way, the end result for us locally, yes, we would. If somehow he could magically wave his wand and eliminate Congress and give us a 14.5% tax rate, anyone who's planning on drawing Social Security or is drawing Social Security would be vastly disappointed. You would be paying in your old age your own medical expenses, and property taxes would have to be roughly quadrupled to pay just for the schools.
Right. The school taxes, what they get from the federal government, what they get from the state and federal government. The federal government pays a lot of our school budget.
Mm-hmm. And Fort Hood would be eliminated, by the way.
Yeah.
I mean, so this is Rand Paul's proposal. Eliminate Fort Hood. Eliminate funding for schools so that we all have to pay it out of property taxes. And if you don't own property, you don't pay that. Let's see, what else? And chop your Social Security and chop your
That's the only way that's feasible. Now, I wish that there were some real productive talk about reality. That speech by Rand Paul, I'm going to equate it with a student council presidential candidate saying there will never be another line in the cafeteria when you wait for your lunch.
Yeah, but again,
it's you're talking fantasy world.
I'm pretty sure Rand Paul is either a medical doctor or a dentist. I know his father was, but I think he is too. He has an extensive education. He's a very intelligent person. And he got up and made this proposal for 14.5% flat tax without detailing what he was going to cut. It took his aides to come out and say, read his previous budget proposals, and then you see it. It would be absolutely devastating. It would be a almost surefire way to generate World War III and a depression simultaneously, which I just am mind-boggled that conservatives have jumped on this and seem to like it. But anyway, I just want you to know that, yeah, that our tax code needs an overhaul.
Massively.
No doubt about it.
It needs to really, really, really be scraped out and restarted.
But the point is, there's a lot of good about our tax code, and whether we like it or not, the reason we didn't have a depression in World War III is we have a government that has enough money to get the job done. You cut our government spending back to the point that he said, and we would have returned to the 1920s. In our governmental orientation, and we would get the same result as we got following the 1920s.
He is a doctor. He's an ophthalmologist.
So the issue is, this is an extremely well-educated man. So I would have to conclude either he has had a stroke and lost most of his intelligence, or he is being intentionally misleading. And I don't think that he needs any further consideration in his run for president after that. I think he's just trying to he makes Matt Drudge look like a balanced journalist. Okay, there's another one here. I could go on this. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and the number's in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
Barron's has an article today that finally agrees with what I found, which means they are brilliant.
It's an obvious sign of brilliance that
yes,
they agree with you.
That they agree with me. What they did is Barron sat down on this argue of whether you should index funds always outperform actively managed mutual funds. So they sat down and took a look at a 10-year annualized return. Now, 10 years obviously takes us back far enough that we went through the dip. We went through the 2009 collapse. And the 2008-2009 collapse and have recovered. So they said, okay, let's compare mutual funds. And you're only using one mutual fund per mutual fund, although there's like five for actual mutual funds. So what they did is they went out there and found that there's about 8,885 actual mutual fund portfolios being managed equity in the United equity funds being managed in the United States for U.S. stocks. And what they found is about 29% of those equal or beat. No, 36% of them equal or beat the S&P 500 over the last 10 years. Did you get that? 36%. It's not that hard to find the right 36%. Now, you could say, okay, well, then maybe they were in small cap stocks or something that do better. Okay, well, if we compare them against their index, like the small cap index or something like that, now it's down to 30% equal or beat their index. Well, yeah, but maybe they had more risk. So they keep you keep working down the line, and what you wind up with is about 18% of mutual fund managers, active managers in the United States over the last 10 years beat their respective index on a risk-adjusted return basis. Now, that's really close to 20%. We often refer to in our business Pareto's rule.
Yeah,
which is the 80-20 rule, which is in any given situation, 20% of the managers will outperform the median. 20%, only 20%, but 20% will give us 64% of what we call the excess return.
Yeah.
And sure enough, Barron's just went back and looked for 10 years and found that around 18% of the funds out there not only outperformed, but outperformed on a risk adjusted basis means they took less or equal risk to their respective index or their respective Vanguard index fund. That's what they measured them against and got a better return.
This isn't surprising to us, but to many people it is. If you have people that professionally invest and they spend a lot of time studying investments and moving forward, then you should have a better return than somebody that isn't studying their investments so much. So that concept is one of those things that I look at and go, of course. The reality is, though, that educations have to keep getting better.
Mm-hmm.
They have to get better technology. They have to continue. And they are. It's something that's the surprising part, is that the numbers haven't really changed over this period of time. They continue to get better at what they're doing as everybody else does.
Now, here is the key. If you go back to 2009 and start investing, the numbers are very different. You only have 9% of the investment managers outperforming from 2009. And this should tell you a lot. In other words, only about half of them. The majority of the outperformance that was created by investment managers was in losing less money in the downturn from 2007 to 2009. So the longer we go into a runaway bull market,
the more likely is that the rest of the world catches up with the professionals.
Right. And then
it's when the downtimes happen that the professionals really shine.
So the issue is that if you use a professional, a good manager, and there's an art to finding them, and let me tell you, I slave at that many hours, even after 33 years of experience. finding good mutual fund managers. If you can find a good mutual fund manager or management firm that has been at it a long time and has a consistent record, and everything is good about that firm, they are moving in the right direction. What Barron's has found is that they are likely to continue to outperform the market over long periods of time. Now, does that mean that your portfolio should outperform the S&P 500? I want to throw a little caveat in here. No. It means that you should have, because there's another article in Barron's that says balanced funds do a lot better than we think they do. What it boils down to is you need to have some bonds, you need to have cash, you need to have other what we call asset preservation elements in your portfolio. So you should not compete with the S&P 500 stock index, although this year it wouldn't have been that hard, with it up 1.something% year to date. But the point that I want to make here is that the propaganda that index funds always outperform active management is just that. It's propaganda. And finally, we have an independent organization, Barron's, who comes back and confirms the 80-20 rule that about 20% of the managers are going to outperform their respective index. It's just a matter of finding them.
Morningstar's averages have shown the active management has beaten the indexes going back as far as you want to look. They just don't have it broken down into what percentage did what, although we could probably do that.
Well, there's an element in here, by the way, that I need to throw in, a little caveat. In order to see this behavior, you have to eliminate the funds that are index funds but claim to be active management fund. So in other words, you have to actually look at the internal fund itself and say, how close is it to the index? For instance, if you have a large cap blend fund, it's neither value nor growth, and it claims it has active management, but you look at it and it's tracking the S&P 500 about 99% of the time, that indicates it's really not an actively managed fund. They're just charging a lot of, and they are going to underperform, by the way. They're just charging higher fees than an index fund to be an index fund, so they don't really have to do anything. And that there's more to it than that. And I could go on and on. For instance, I mentioned last week that the MSCI index, international index, which is the standard index for emerging markets companies, chose not to include all the A shares in China. Little caveat right here. Chinese shares dropped 10% last week.
They were up.
And they are continuing to plummet.
Yeah.
They were down 10% for the week, though.
Yeah. On Friday, they dropped 10% and then ended down only 6%. But if you're talking about from the bottom, that was a 14% drop in 1 week.
A 14%, okay.
And they came back up so that it ended the week with a 10% drop.
Oh, well, only 10% a week.
Right. I mean,
you run that for 52 weeks and it gets kind of interesting.
It never gets to zero, though.
Drop.
It never gets to zero because 10% down is still 10% of the thing it was before. So,
anyway, so you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and we got about 5 minutes left in the show. Or it's not a show, I'm sorry.
The program. You can't see us. Well, I can see us.
Are we programmed?
I believe we are, by both nature and nurture.
So we're proceeding along very nicely. The Greeks are likely to exit, and Merkel is unhappy about that. And I can tell you she's unhappy about that because the banks would lose a lot of money.
Well, let me say the shale industry, It's in deep. There's a lot of debt in the shale industry.
They have a lot of grease.
The numbers are that 10% of their revenue is being used for interest payments,
mm-hmm.
Which is a lot. That's a large amount. It's not anywhere near as bad as Greece, but please expect to see bankruptcies in the shale industry. One of the good things about that, it sounds like that's a horrible thing. It is if you are the shale company that goes bankrupt. However, those assets are still going to be there in the bankruptcy, so other companies will buy them. So expect to see some mergers and acquisitions going on in here as the weaker companies fail. They have proven oil fields. When they go bankrupt, they're going to sell their assets to the bigger companies. So don't expect it to be too horrible.
But there's a lesson here. You know, mortgage-backed securities were hot a few years ago, and they blew up, and you think, well, if I just hang on to them, they'll be okay. And We just heard that $700 billion worth of them are no longer going to be traded.
Right.
So what was hot a few years ago, we look at now and see is falling apart. What was hot in the recent past, and I had people calling me wanting to know if they could get involved in buying into one of these or buying into one of these partnerships
right.
that was drilling for oil in the fracking boom. And if you got into one of those, there's a pretty fair chance at this point that you're about to lose all your money. Whatever is hot, whatever is the big thing, whatever people call you up and say you need to invest in this, and by the way, that commercial was one of those things, generally speaking, somewhere down the road is what is going to completely blow up and you lose all your money. Anytime that somebody says you don't lose money when the stock market goes down, this is a sure thing.
Yes.
This is guaranteed.
All the red lights should go off. The flags should start waving and the alarms going at loud volume.
That means you are at high risk to lose all of your money suddenly and unexpectedly. And just put that in the back of your head and remember that as best you can.
Yeah, euphoria is never the reason you should be buying something. And that even includes buying cars or buying houses. And this is something that constantly puzzles me. It shouldn't puzzle me. I just take it for granted now, but I still am puzzled by the underlying thing. You know those big purple gorillas over the car dealerships? The big inflated
I'm familiar
gorillas.
With them. Yes, I've never actually met one.
Right. Those increase the sales at the car dealership by 20%. When they're on display.
Why don't they just leave them up all the time?
I don't know. Maybe declines after a few. Yeah, but the idea is that somebody has $30,000+ and they spent it because they saw a big purple gorilla. No.
And then they ran for Congress.
Right. Or maybe they get a free hot dog in the process or a balloon.
That's it. That's the big.
Keep in mind that when you do an impulse that you say, I must buy this because I see it right now. It takes an effort, but use the effort to say, why am I so excited about this? I'm excited about this because everyone's doing it. If everyone's doing it and it's monetary, it generally means the price is too high.
Can I confess that I just went through this process?
Yes.
Okay. I have a car. I have a 2007 yellow FJ Cruiser Toyota. And I was really unhappy with it. I was unhappy with it to the point where I really felt like I needed to get a new vehicle, like a pickup truck or something, which is about $35,000. And I was just feeling unhappy, but I didn't know exactly what vehicle to get. So I went online, and I went to a site that takes me around to all the various cars that I could buy. And it asked me a whole lot of questions about whether I wanted to buy new or used, and I wanted to buy used, and what color vehicle I wanted, wanted the capabilities and everything else about it. And it said, we have found your car. We have found your ideal car. And up pops a picture of my vehicle, only with about 100,000 more miles on it.
Well, that's a downgrade.
So what I did instead, and this is what I would recommend, is I went out and had my car detailed and put new tires on it. And now I've got a new car. So, because my car was dirty and my tires are worn out, I wanted to spend $35,000 on a new car. And I really wanted to do that, but I didn't do it. Anyway, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and we're out of time for today, Saturday, June 20th. I'm trying to make it later than it is. And if you'd like to talk to us off the air, we do manage people's investment portfolios for a living, and we charge fees only for doing that. We don't sell anything. You can give us a call locally. We have voicemail on the weekend, live people during the week, 947-1111. Or
you can reach that same voicemail or live people, depending on what day you're calling, at 800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email us directly, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, listen to podcasts, read our philosophy, see our Made for Radio faces. But I warn you, before listening to podcasts, please take your psychiatric medicines.